I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Marissa Renee Lee is a Harvard grad, a best-selling author, and was a deputy director in the Obama White House. She always prided herself on being competent and in control until she was diagnosed with long COVID a few years ago, which shattered her world. The simplest tasks, like cooking, became too difficult because her thinking was so clouded. Some days she was so exhausted she could barely get out of bed. At first, she denied that something was seriously wrong, but that only made her feel more anxious and alone. Marissa Renee Lee writes in her new book about how her health crisis changed her identity and how accepting her new self is actually grounded in hope. It's titled Waiting for Dawn, Living with Uncertainty. A few years ago, she wrote the book Grief is Love. So today on The Connection, Living with the Unexpected, the Many Guises of Uncertainty, Why Loss and Change Are Inevitable, and That Is Okay. Marissa Renee Lee, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You begin your book talking about your struggles to make bacon for your family for breakfast, that you could not master something that you had been cooking since you were a girl. What was going on?
Oh my gosh. Honestly, looking back at it, that is when I should have known that something was seriously wrong. I love to cook. I have been a successful home cook and baker literally since I had an easy bake oven around age 5.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I just kept burning entire cookie sheets of bacon. Like my internal chef clock completely disappeared. And when I say bacon, I feel like it's important to add that this was like overpriced, fancy bacon shipped in from Wisconsin, where my husband is from. And so every sheet of bacon that I burned cost quite a bit of money as well. And it was my husband and frankly, his disgust that forced me to recognize that something was seriously wrong. And it completely altered my identity, my illness.
You describe what it's like to have that brain fog. I guess it's the kind of clouded thinking that seems to accompany long COVID. Describe that for our listeners.
It was honestly the most bizarre experience for me personally. You know, I realized in the midst of it that I had previously taken my intelligence for granted. You know, I was used to being someone who could sit in the Oval Office and have, you know, the perfect talking points for President Obama and very good at distilling lots of information quickly. And all of a sudden, it was like my brain just stopped working. You know, I would open up the refrigerator to look for sugar. No one keeps sugar in the fridge, as far as I know. I kept leaving my car door open overnight in the garage. And then, you know, the next day, not able to figure out why the car isn't working properly. I would go to make a dish that, you know, I make for my family every 2 weeks, and I would forget to make one of the key components. Talking to a client, I would say, you know, I have three things that I want to share with you. In the middle of thing one, thing two would just completely disappear. Wow. And I couldn't get it back. So it was really scary, honestly.
Did you think you were going crazy?
I definitely had moments where I wondered if there was something wrong in terms of my mental health. Excuse me. I remember this one moment, probably about 6 weeks after I got COVID. I had just finished an eye exam at BJ's, and I was sitting in the parking lot crying hysterically. And I'm thinking, you know, what's wrong? Like, I don't actually have anything that I'm sad about. Like, something really strange is going on here. And it turns out that the way long COVID works, it is fundamentally immune system dysfunction that then triggers nervous system dysfunction and creates all of these different problems in your body, including your brain. And things like anxiety and depression are very common side effects. But I was in denial. So at the time, I thought maybe I was like losing it a little bit.
Well, and even adding to that, you talk about these debilitating headaches, the kind of excruciating pain. Yeah, you're just making a face there. Excruciating pain that accompanied these dark headaches.
It was some of the worst pain I've ever experienced. And I've had other health issues and, you know, gone through egg donor IVF and pregnancy loss and plenty of painful things, unfortunately. But these headaches, I mean, I could barely sleep when I could sleep, I would often wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes already crying from the pain.
Wow.
One morning I woke up and I realized a piece was missing from my night guard. And I just assume I bit it off at some point in my sleep because the pain was so bad, even when I was not fully conscious of it. At one point, I got into a car accident, the first car accident that I'd been in since I was a teenager. And I absolutely think that the pain contributed to my inability to be, the normal, effective driver that I've been for the last couple of decades.
Well, I feel the need to ask you, how are you feeling now?
I am doing much better, thank God. It's been a journey, but I decided to share my long COVID publicly in the fall of 2024. And in sharing it, there was actually a woman who was sort of at the end of her long COVID recovery who was following me on social media because of my writing on grief. And it helped her, figure out how to cope with this illness and the changes to her identity. And she connected me to her physician, who's amazing. And so I just like to share, in case this helps anyone out there, the three most effective things for me. I'm on a drug called low-dose naltrexone. I've been on it for almost 2 years, and that's been incredibly helpful. I do a lot of breath work. I developed severe asthma in both of my lungs as a result of the long COVID, and these breathing exercises have allowed me to completely heal my lungs. And then the third thing, and I just started this in February, but this is what has enabled me to do interviews like these, to have a couple of book tour events. I'm on a micro dose of the GLP-1
Oh,
Zepbound.
that's
Game
fascinating.
changer.
Game
Game
changer.
changer. Absolutely.
Wow. I mean,
Absolutely.
this.
Within 48 hours, I noticed a difference.
So, do you feel like a different person having gone through this and still dealing with some of the residual effects? Are you a different kind of Marissa Lee?
1,000%. I don't think you can go through this kind of deeply painful, both physically and emotionally experience that lasts a couple of years and be the same person. And frankly, at a certain point, I decided I wasn't going to be the same person when I got better. Because if you're going to go through something that awful, I wanted to make sure that I was intentional about integrating the lessons of that season. Like, I am a more patient person. I am, more laid back a little bit and just accepting of, the uncertainties in day-to-day life, even just like the little ones. And I feel like I am even more committed to the concept of hope than I was before. And I don't know, like I feel like it's easier for me to be happy now too.
Well, I want to get to hope and I want to get to happy, but I'm also thinking about, and you write about this, and it is true that, as a human being, we change, we grow up, we have childhoods, we have adolescence, we're young adults, we have friends, we lose friends, we have, long-term, hopefully long-term relationships that last over time. But these are changes that seem to sort of come, sort of evolve with us as we
Yes.
grow up. But what you're talking about is a change that is imposed
Yeah.
upon you and others who have suffered similarly.
Yes. And I'll say, the thing that kept coming up for me is this is going to happen to all of us at some point. Not necessarily long COVID, but maybe the long-term relationship that you thought was going to be the forever thing ends up not being the forever thing. Maybe the job that you've had for a couple of decades is no longer available as like technology changes. Maybe you're dealing with a health crisis with your spouse or, heaven forbid, your child. It's going to happen to all of us at some point. And so getting comfortable with the idea that, yes, our identity is going to be impacted when these big uncertainties arise, I think that makes it easier to make sense of it when it happens to you.
Because it seems natural to, when something like this is happening, just to say, this isn't happening. This cannot be happening to me. I
Yes.
just, I'm not prepared for this. I don't have the skills to deal with it.
Yep.
It cannot be happening.
Yep. I spent months, oh my gosh, chasing any other diagnosis besides long COVID, which you know, some people don't even believe that it's a real thing. A lot of physicians don't know how to treat it or what's helpful or how to clearly diagnose it. And so I didn't want to have it. You know, I didn't want to have something that no one could tell me, this is exactly how we're going to fix it. This is exactly how long it's going to take. This is what it's going to be like from start to finish and how you're going to feel. You know, no one could answer those questions. And even now, people still can't really answer those questions. So I pushed back hard until I found myself in Greece teaching a writing retreat and I couldn't breathe.
Right.
Like it was so terrifying. I literally couldn't breathe. My larynx was over 70% blocked.
Wow.
And I had asthma in both of my lungs and I just didn't know it. And that was when I had to face reality and figure out how I was going to engage with this situation.
We all have to deal with uncertainty. I was even thinking, having read your book, uncertainty is on my mind, you know, for the next 24 hours. And I was thinking as I was coming to work, you know, will the train break down? Will my car start?
Yeah.
You know, all the things
yeah.
that we rely on happening in life, very mundane kinds of things, and the kinds of health crises that you were dealing with and the kind of uncertainty that's just embedded in life itself.
Yes, yes. I think about it a lot as a parent. You know, we have a four-year-old and you can't control what their life is going to be like. You know, like you can feed into them in all of the best ways and love them well and teach them to read and you know, do all the things. But like, you don't actually know how they're going to turn out or who they're going to become. And so, you know, getting comfortable with uncertainty in the day to day, I think it makes it easier to live well when you just accept uncertainty as a normal part of life.
How do you do that? What do you
First
say
all,
to yourself?
You say to yourself, you're not in control to the extent that you think you are, particularly for someone like me who loves to be in control, loves to be in
me
charge.
Too.
I love a spreadsheet and a list. And, you know, I like to make a plan. I like strategy. And all of those things are important and they matter. And, you know, I still work hard to live an intentional life, but with the understanding underneath all of it that things can change at any moment. And so do your best to be present with whatever your experience is today.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And Marissa Renee Lee is our guest today on The Connection. She's got a brand new book. It's called Waiting for Dawn, Living with Uncertainty. And she has been talking about her struggles to understand and I guess accept the fact that she had or has long COVID. And it has raised a whole host of issues about things like uncertainty and hope. We have much more to talk about after this very short break, so do stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with our guest, Marissa Renee Lee. Her world was turned upside down when she was diagnosed with long COVID and had to learn to embrace uncertainty, which she writes about in her new book, Waiting for Dawn. You also write about grief, and that's something that you wrote about in your first book, Grief is Love. In this book, you talk about something called gray grief. Define that for us.
Yes. So gray grief is the grief of uncertainty. You know, when I wrote Grief is Love, I decided my definition of grief was going to be grief is the repeated experience of learning to live in the midst of a significant loss. But when I found myself sick and, you know, sort of trying to figure out if that definition fit my current life, I realized it didn't because I was the loss. You know, like I was dealing with significant loss of self, you know, loss of the life that I had always lived, loss of the way that I like to do things, loss of my health. Like it just went on and on and on. And I realized that, you know, in this space of deep uncertainty, nothing is totally clear or straightforward. Everything is unknown from, you know, will I be able to take a shower today? You know, like, will I have the strength or the energy for that? To, is this new treatment going to work? And the image that just kept coming up for me was heavy fog. Like, we live up on a hill in the Hudson Valley, and when it's foggy, you do not want to drive up here. It's truly dangerous. It's like driving through like New England clam chowder. And so that image was what spawned, gray grief, because that's what it is. It's the grief of the unknown. Nothing is black or white or totally clear.
You're right, and I think it's very true. We certainly live in a society, I think, I don't know if the U.S. is alone in this, or we're kind of grief averse. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to name it. You just rolled your eyes at me, and you're nodding your head
So
enthusiastically. So
bad.
bad. But how does that make it maybe hard for people like you, or dealing with all these losses when we live in a society that, wants to put a happy face on those things?
I know. I mean, that is just something I am constantly pushing back against in my work. I'm very, very anti-toxic positivity because I think it causes a lot of harm. It puts people in a place where they feel like, if they're having these big, challenging emotions like anger, sadness, grief, depression, disappointment, etc., that they have done something wrong. When really these things are just a normal part of life. And frankly, having a small child has been a great reminder of the both and in life. Watching a little kid go from losing their mind upset about God knows what little thing to being totally fine 5 minutes later. For me, that's a reminder, like, this is how we came into the world. It's okay to have lots of big feelings. And when you lose some essential part of yourself or someone you love in the world, like, you should have really big feelings about that. It's a big deal, and it's okay that you are sad or struggling. Like, you get through it by acknowledging the emotions, not by ignoring them.
Let me read something that you write in the introduction to the book. It's just a sentence or two. And I will not ever urge you to make meaning out of your pain. I will not diminish your experience of promising you it has a purpose. So on the one hand, we want to ascribe purpose and meaning to our lives, but in the same line of thinking, some things do not make sense. They just are.
Yes. You know what I was thinking about? I mean, this is horrible, but the thing that I was thinking about when I wrote that are friends of mine who have lost children, particularly friends who have lost children to violence. Like, I will never try to claim that there was a reason for that. Like, I cannot do that. And while, I am obviously someone who has created a lot of meaning out of the things that have happened in my life, I don't want anyone to feel like that that's what they have to do, because really the priority should be figuring out how you're going to heal and how you're going to live with whatever losses you have to deal with. Nothing else.
Your previous book, Grief is Love, it was about several things, including your mom's death when you were relatively young. Your mother-in-law died, it sounds like, relatively recently, within the last couple of years. Your struggles with infertility. You had a cousin who was murdered. I mean, this is a lot for anyone to try to sort of work their way through. How is grief love? I mean, what is the connection between grief and love?
So what I realized, and I partially realized this in an interview conversation that I had with Sabrina Fulton, who is Trayvon Martin's mother,
Oh,
for
sure.
folks who aren't familiar with her. And she said, "I still love my son, and my son still loves me." And when she used that present tense language, all of a sudden I realized, like, this is why grief is painful. Like, I still love my mother, and I believe that my mother still loves me, but she's not here to act on that love. And that's where the pain comes in. She's not here to watch my son. She wasn't around to meet my husband or be at my wedding. She wasn't here the last couple of years to, like, coordinate meals and different things as I navigated this long COVID experience. And that's where the sadness comes in, because of course you still want them to be here. At this point, my mom's been gone for over 18 years. And so while I do still want her to be here, it's almost like a form of magical thinking at this point thinking, you know what I mean? Because like my life today is just so far away from what my life was the last time I spoke to her.
Your mom had MS. I mean, she had a series of, pretty serious and chronic ailments. Do you feel, in certain ways, with your long COVID, that you were living a bit of the life that she lived when she was a
Oh,
mom or
Lord.
a young woman, raising a family?
So, one of the big things that I had to work through was sort of separating her story from my story, because I realized once I acknowledged how sick I was that one of the big fears that I carried was becoming a sick parent after having been the child of a sick parent. And it's been hard. Like, it has absolutely taken a lot of reflection and processing and therapy to make sense of her story and my story and see where they intersect. And also, just telling myself what happened to her isn't what's going to happen to you. Because in her case, I was 13 and she was 37 when she first got sick, which is just mind-boggling to me now that I'm in my 40s. And she just got progressively worse until she died. And she died, at my husband's age. He turns 49 in a couple of days, and she died right after her 49th birthday. And so I needed to really get to a place of acceptance of my illness and acceptance of the fact that, I'm going to heal. This is different. And then I'll say one of the unexpected sort of benefits almost of ending up with this illness was I felt like I got a better understanding for how hard things were for her. Because, she wasn't going to complain to her 13-year-old. You know what I mean? But like being the mom who, is sick and has the kid, like I was like, oh, like this was really hard.
And it sounds like you pride yourself on being a good caretaker, that that's actually a skill that you have. You're
Yes.
good
And
at
that I
this.
like to do.
Which helps, right? Right?
And, it took us 5 years to get to our son. And never in those 5 years did I imagine that he'd be 2.5 and I would be too sick to pick him up. And it just, it was devastating. But we found ways to adapt and still have fun. And I think he's learned a lot about, how people can be different, how it's okay to sometimes not feel well, how to be more compassionate and caring of other people. But yeah, it's been a challenge.
You're right. Illness, grief, pain, and disability have humbled me.
Oh my gosh. 1,000%. Classic type A overachiever, Harvard, Wall Street, White House. I'm like, I can do anything, And I'm like, you can do anything, and you have to own that you're human, and being human means pain and uncertainty and disappointment and all the rest. Yeah, very, very much humbled.
What is I think all of us struggle with, what do you say to someone? It may be someone in the family died, or they're dealing with a chronic illness as you were. What was
Yeah.
helpful from friends and family, and what was not helpful for you?
It's a great question. Helpful was validation. In particular, I have a close friend who is a clinical psychologist and another close friend who is a doctor. And, validation from them in particular of how difficult this experience was that I was navigating, it meant a lot because it made me feel, frankly, it made me feel less weak, for lack of a better term. Because it was hard. Like, there were definitely days where I would just be crying for hours and not able to really get out of bed and, really struggled. And it was incredibly lonely. And so anything that validated the experience was helpful. And then for a long time, I couldn't even really talk to people on the phone because I would start to get shortness of breath. And so, they would find other ways of engaging, like sending cards or a fun book or, some little chocolates or other treat in the mail. So thinking about how you can still continue to connect with someone who's in a difficult situation, whether by doing something practical, like my doctor friend found me a new primary care physician because she was like, you need better, more hands-on care. Like, and so she just did that. Another friend helped with a work project that I didn't want to lose. Think about the practical things like those, sending a meal, watching a kid, walking a dog, and then think about joy. Like it was really hard for me to access joy in that season, but when folks would send little things, I did feel joy and some amount of comfort.
Even little emojis and things like that, just to kind of smiley faces or whatever.
Yes, I have. Oh my gosh, I have a guy friend who is, I mean, he's a university president, and he sends me the most ridiculous things on Instagram just to like make me laugh. So yes, those things matter.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Marissa Renee Lee, our guest today on The Connection. She's the author of a new book called Waiting for Dawn, and it's subtitled Living with Uncertainty. Let me raise something which I found really interesting, and you talk about something called Superwoman Schema. In fact, let me turn to the correct page. Let me just, I'll quote you again, if you don't mind, Marissa. And this is someone named Cheryl Woods Giscombe. Giscombe? Yes. Developed to let, called the Superwoman Schema. And I'll read what you wrote. SWS refers when Black women have a perceived obligation to present an image of strength, an obligation to suppress emotions, resistance to being vulnerable or depending on others for help, motivation to succeed despite limited resources, and prioritization of caregiving over self-care. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
But I want to dig into that with you. Is this, can you identify with that?
Unfortunately, yes. I would say
it's a lot.
I would
it's
say
a
that
lot.
Was, it is, it is. And I am very fortunate. I work with a bereavement expert and researcher at Harvard, Dr. Christy Dankla. She is amazing. And when she sent me that research paper, I was like, stop. Like you are talking directly to me. Like I was like laughing because it was so spot on. But that was me most of my life. You know, like I said, I was 13 when my mom first got sick. And for 3.5 years, we didn't know what was wrong with her. You know, she was in and out of the hospital, constantly going to see specialists. All of a sudden, you know, she went from PTA and jazzercise and working full time to disabled in a matter of months. And there was nothing I could do to fix that. So instead, I decided I was going to double down on, you know, being my overachiever self. And that's how I would make life easier for my parents. You know, straight A's, all the awards, class president, I'll go to a good college, I'll get a good job, and then I'll help them even more. Like that is exactly how I lived. I suppressed every single negative emotion and fear that I had. And it resulted in these like horrible stomach aches that I had, you know, by the time I was 14, 15 years old. And I've been on medication for my stomach on and off ever since.
Wow.
Like I couldn't deal with the emotions. And so, you know, you just store them physically, which is horrible. Please don't do that, people.
But you're talking about stress, right? I mean, that would explain just the sort of ongoing, gotta be perfect kind of stress.
Yeah. And then I did it again when she got sick with breast cancer. She was diagnosed the week I was graduating from college. And I decided that week that I would take a year off and move back to my parents' house and just, you know, help them figure it out. And I went from there to working on Wall Street during the height of the financial crisis and starting a nonprofit on the side that, you know, we ran from the basement of this investment bank. Not dealing with feelings. No, I can't deal with the feelings, but like I can just keep pushing forward and push myself right into a job in the White House. So it worked until it didn't. And with long COVID, you just can't live like that. Like I don't have the strength to hide my feelings because I'm too sick.
You tell it's a very painful story, and I hope you feel comfortable talking about this on the air, but you had an aunt who contacted you because she was taking care of her daughter's baby. Her daughter was missing, and she needed help. She wanted you to help her.
Yeah.
And you really struggled with how to respond to her request. Take us through the sort of back and forth that you were thinking.
Oh, it was so hard. So at the time, you know, I had, I think he was almost 2 years old, our son. Yeah. And my mother-in-law was dying from stage 4 breast cancer, several states away. We were on a plane between every month and every other month with a toddler and very actively involved in managing her care. I, at the time, was also primary breadwinner. My husband was a stay-at-home dad for the first 2 years of Bennett's life. And just the pressure of all of it was unbelievable. And, I remember we took my son to get his first haircut, and I came out of the appointment and had a text message from one cousin telling me that my cousin Amani was missing. She had just had a baby 4 or 5 weeks prior. And by the time I was brought into the situation, she'd been missing for almost 4 days. And everything I knew about missing persons cases came from like Netflix and random TV shows. And I mean, it was like such an overwhelming, unbelievable, and sad situation that I now understand is incredibly common, unfortunately. And when my aunt reached out, I knew in my gut that saying yes wasn't the right answer, but saying no to my aunt, who I love, and also if I was right, which unfortunately I assumed that my cousin had been killed, that would be her fourth child to die and her second child in only 3 years. And so the idea of saying no to her, like it was really, really hard, but I just knew that yes wasn't the right answer. And when I said no, she was super understanding, and by then she actually agreed with me that the baby should stay with her. That also gave me the space to say, you know what, these investigators are not doing enough. My cousin was young, poor, black, uneducated, all the things, and it was the South, and I was like, nobody cares. And so I called up a bunch of friends, and we launched our own nationwide campaign and, public engagement, PR, media, all the things. On a Sunday, and her body was found that
Oh,
Friday.
by Friday of that week. Oh my goodness. I hate to do this, but we have to take a
It's
very
okay.
short break, and I want to pick up on that after this short break. And again, talking with Marissa Renee Lee. She's got a new book called Waiting for Dawn: Living with Uncertainty. And we have much more to talk about after this very short break. So do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Let me just do a little recap here. We all make plans. We map out the direction we want our life to take. We even fantasize about the future. It is only human to want to know what's ahead. But what happens when things go upside down? Our guest is Marissa Renee Lee, author of a new book called Waiting for Dawn, and it's about how to live with uncertainty. I'm so sorry about what happened to your aunt and to your cousin, and it's just so tragic and so painful, and I'm sure
Thank
painful
you.
for you to even sort of relive this, especially in a public setting on the air. But I also feel like it there's such a powerful message there. You were struggling, with your own life and how to say yes or how to say no to a beloved aunt. But I think what's interesting is that she accepted your answer. And I wonder,
She did.
this was the answer of no, I can't help you right now.
Yeah.
And she must have understood what you were going through.
Yeah, she was. I mean, honestly, she was really wonderful about it, even in the midst of all that she was holding. And what she ended up ultimately sharing was, she was so proud of the job that Matt, my husband, and I were doing raising our son.
Yeah.
And like, that's what made her think of it, which is a tremendous compliment. And, when I said no, I knew it was the right answer, and I knew that there were other things that I could do to help her, both the practical, like sending groceries or, dinner, et cetera, to her house, and also like the strategic. Like, I could leverage my network and make sure that my aunt got closure, because she deserved that at a minimum. And we were able to get her that. I know what the statistics look like around missing Black women, and they usually stay missing. Like, these cases more often than not go unsolved. And I didn't want that to be our story. And so The situation actually just came to full resolution last week. In the background of my book tour, my aunt was going to court every day for the trial for my cousin's killer, who also happened to be her husband. He was convicted on all counts and sentenced late last week. So yeah, it's been an intense couple of weeks.
Does that feel like justice to you? Or even
I
closure? I mean, I can't
struggle.
imagine there's ever
Yeah.
closure on something like
Yeah,
that.
it feels more like closure. And I just, with some of the work that I do in the world, like I can't help but think about like the root causes of violence and what may have happened to this person to allow them to be this way. And then I think about this child who's gonna have to grow up knowing that his dad killed his mom. And like, how is he going to make sense of that? And so it's closure, but it's just such a complex situation.
I did say at the beginning of the show, I did also want to talk about hope. And I have to say that that
Yes.
hope is very much embedded in the story. In fact, you tell the story of your grandfather, who was a, I guess, a farmer in was it Georgia? And he wanted to, get out of that life and to go to some place where he could raise a family and feel safe. But he had to deal with the sort of reality of the racism, frankly, of Georgia. Tell us that story. It's incredible.
So my grandfather was born in 1921. So I think this happened in like the late 40s, I want to say. Both my grandparents are from rural Georgia, and my grandfather worked on like a large farm, and he was amazing when it came to getting things to grow. Like both of my grandparents were. He was more fruits and vegetables, she was more flowers. And he knew that staying in the South was not the best option for him and his family. At the time, my father hadn't been born yet, but two of my uncles and my aunt. And so he decided to accept a new position with like the ultimate goal of making it up north to New York or somewhere else. And the night before my grandparents and uncles and aunt were set to leave Georgia, the man who owned the property where my grandfather worked showed up at my grandparents' house with these things called trace chains, which I didn't know what they were, but they are these like very thick metal chains that you use to attach a horse to a wagon.
Oh my gosh.
And obviously the intent to beat him into submission, keep him from leaving because they wanted to keep him. He was a good worker. My grandfather met them at the door with a shotgun, and my grandparents and uncles and aunt left the next day. And I think it was like within like a year or two, my grandfather was offered an opportunity here in New York in the Hudson Valley where I live now, and he took it. So
Yeah, I mean,
he
and
was
because
committed.
but he wanted a better life for his family. He believed that there it was one and he was able to create it. I mean, that in certain ways is the definition of hope.
Yes, because the thing about hope, and this is not just Marissa's opinion, this is the actual science of hope. When you have the belief that whatever your circumstances are today can be improved in the future, that belief then drives actions that support that future. And so, when I was at my worst and, couldn't talk on the phone, couldn't get out of the bed some days, could barely breathe, I had to believe that that was not how I was going to live forever. Because that belief then enabled me to find the best doctors, try alternative therapies, get all the rest, even though I didn't want to. And ultimately, it got me to a place 2 years later where I am much better. I'm not perfect. There's still a lot that I can't do, but I'm so much better than I was.
You write about your grandfather that he, and I'm quoting here, left the racial terror of the South for the quiet, subtle racism of the North. So I don't know which is preferable. Is it preferable when people are doing it behind your back or face to face?
Yeah, I mean, I think the North was just less violent at the time when it came to racism. But it's funny, when I was starting to put together some notes for the proposal for that book, I was sitting in a coffee shop in Beacon, New York, which has become like a hot spot and like super hipster and cool. But back in the day, it was poor and black mostly. And there's a diner on Main Street in Beacon. And, you know, my dad would tell this story of when my grandparents first came up to New York, when black people would go eat at this diner, after they left, they could hear dishes breaking.
Oh.
Because instead of washing the dishes that the black people ate off of, they would smash them out behind the diner. And so, you know, it was still something that they had to deal with, obviously, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't people showing up in the middle of the night trying to beat you.
You wrote in your previous book, Grief is Love, that racism is a form of grief. How so?
At the end of the day, like I am American. You know, my family has been here for multiple generations, and yet, you know, you don't get the benefit of full American safety, freedom, liberty, etc., if you happen to walk around with black skin. And there's grief in that because it's not, you know, you sometimes will hear people say things like, go back to where you came from. Like, I don't know where I'm from. Like, my people came here as slaves. Like, I don't even know what that would look like. That's completely ridiculous. And I love America. I love being an American. In this moment, that's a challenging thing, but like, I still love my country. And so to love something and not be loved fully in return, it absolutely causes pain.
And grief, I mean, something to mourn.
Yeah, because there's no other identity for me in terms of, you know, nationality outside of being an American. Like I don't even just have, you know, my US passport. I even have a diplomatic US passport from my time serving in the Obama administration. Like I took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. Like I love this country, and yet it fails me and people who look like me over and over and over again every single day.
You mentioned the fact that you worked on Wall Street for a time, and that there were times when you were the only person of color in the room. What kind of pressure on you to, be that perfect black person, black woman?
It's funny. So pressure was real, but I also, and this is probably, you know, sort of some of my grandfather's energy, I decided I was going to take advantage of the situation. A couple of years before I joined the bank that I worked for, there had been a reparations lawsuit. It was a privately held bank that had been around since 1818, and the big business that I actually worked in was commodity trade finance. And, you know, back in the day, tobacco was one of our major exports, a big commodity. And if you were in the tobacco business, decent chance somewhere on your balance sheet, you had people who looked like me. And so they'd had, you know, it was like this big public to-do. And so I went there knowing that I was going to be an outsider basically the entire time. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to ask for everything. Like, I'm going to ask for the hardest, most interesting clients. I'm going to ask to work for this guy who I think is really smart and like genuinely a good guy who I can learn from. I'm going to ask this old white guy to be my mentor. I'm going to ask this other old white guy to be my mentor. Like, I went in and I was like, I want to do a good job and I want to learn as much as possible and I want to take as much as I can from this experience. And so I'm just going to ask for everything. And I got pretty much all of it, and it was amazing.
Wow. Is there a lesson there?
That's an interesting question. I think the lesson is, you know, especially when I think about, I talk a lot to high school students, and, you know, get a lot of questions about race and racism from high school students of color. And I tell them, you know, you can't change the fact that you are, you know, Asian American, Black, Native, Latino, whatever, but you can choose to own your identity and ask for whatever you feel entitled to. Like, don't let the fact that you are different or you are the quote unquote outsider keep you from asking for things that other people wouldn't think twice about.
So just do it in a way.
Yeah, just do it. Like, just go. And that was always the encouragement that I got from my parents. Like, it doesn't matter that, you know, my dad would be like, doesn't matter that you're the girl, doesn't matter that you're black. Like, you're smart, you're gonna work hard, ask for whatever you want and see what happens.
Well, let me ask you about our upcoming, 250th birthday of the United States of America. You're now covering your entire face, but you knew this was coming because, and here we are, the dismantling of the Voting Rights Act.
I know.
DEI under fire. I could, list a whole bunch of things that are going on in this country. So how do you see, or how do you even think about celebrating the United States of America?
I don't think we should be celebrating ourselves right now. I feel like we are a kid who has misbehaved horribly and doesn't deserve a birthday party. Honestly, I don't think we have a right to be celebratory right now, just given how much people are hurting, people of all races and genders and backgrounds. Like, this is a really tough time for a lot of people. People are making choices. I read, I think it was in The Atlantic recently, a veteran from Afghanistan is having to go to food banks to feed his children because gas is so expensive. Yeah. Like, we should not be living like this. It's absolutely disgusting. And the thing that keeps coming up for me, and I talk about this a lot in the grief space, is there is no healing without acknowledgement. Like, we have to acknowledge the various harms that we have done to other Americans, whether you're talking about Native Americans, African Americans, LGBTQ folks who are just constantly under fire right now, it feels like, in order for us to heal and actually have something to celebrate. And until we do that, I don't really think there is much for us to be celebrating right now, honestly.
I was thinking of something that Chief Justice John Roberts said. Now, this goes back to, I think, when he was being confirmed for the Supreme Court, saying the election of Barack Obama means that, in a sense, that systemic racism does not exist. How do you respond to that?
That's hilarious. I think people confuse the exception for the norm. Like, Barack Obama is an exceptional human being with an exceptional story. But most Black people, most Black and brown boys, like, they will never even come close to that place. Because at the end of the day, we haven't figured out how to ensure equal access to opportunity. Like, I'm not saying every Black person should become the next Barack Obama. No, that's crazy. I'm not saying every little Latino boy is going to go to Harvard or Yale. No, that's also ridiculous. But all of our children should be able to have the opportunity to achieve those things if they are capable of those things. And right now, equality of opportunity is not distributed equally in this country.
We're almost out of time here, but I noticed the two books that you have written are about grief, about loss and grief. How did you become the grief girl or the grief lady?
Oh, Lord. I became the grief lady by accident. I was just reflecting on this. I was so angry in early 2020. I was sick from a pregnancy loss. We were all living through the pandemic. I missed my mom, and I wrote this article for Glamour where I said, my mom's been dead for 12 years and no, I'm not over it and I'll never be over it. So stop asking. And that really resonated with people. Yeah. And then unfortunately, a week and a half later, George Floyd was murdered. And suddenly I was the girl who does racial equity and grief. And it just sort of snowballed from there.
Are you comfortable with that?
I am. I feel like, unfortunately, I am well equipped to talk a lot about grief and loss. I wish I wasn't. But, my life story is what it is. And, I want to use every bit of it for good. And I also like to talk about joy. And I think that always surprises people. And I'm like, yes, I'm the grief girl, but I like pink and I like to laugh and I love Beyonce and bourbon.
Well, Marissa Renee Lee, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. And I should say to our listeners, she's got a whole pink, looks like bookcase behind her. So yes, she loves pink. And her new book is called Waiting for Dawn, Living with Uncertainty. And a previous book that she wrote just a couple of years ago is Grief is Love. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Produced today by Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks so much.